Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, The Warmth of Other Suns, epic story of America's great migration, tells the story of that great migration of Southern blacks into the cities of the North, and it's told through the eyes of three people who made the trip in the middle of the last century. It's told, or put together, or organized. The author of this book is the Pulitzer Prize winner, Isabel Wilkerson, who's been in Chapel Hill talking about this book and about her experience. Miss Wilkerson, I mean, in the whole context of your book, may I call you Isabel? Is
yes,
it okay?
Please do.
And if you'd call me DG, that would be great.
Thank
as
you.
Well. But this is an extraordinary story, both because it's essentially the biographies of three people, and then it's also, for some of us, or for me, a tormenting reminder of the place of African Americans in Southern life, and then not only that, but the struggle to leave, and then the struggle once they got there. How in the world did you get off on this topic?
Well, for one thing, I'm a product of this great migration, and in fact, I wouldn't even exist had there been no great migration, because my mother migrated from Rome, Georgia, and my father from Southern Virginia, and they both migrated at different times to Washington, D.C., which was one of the great receiving stations for people from the Carolinas, as you probably know. And they would never have met otherwise, because they would have been growing up in their own respective worlds. They finally realized they were the right people for one another. I almost didn't make it into the world.
Oh, why?
It took them forever to
Now, did they tell
that.
The story? Do you grow
well,
up hearing this
they
story?
They married late in life uh-huh. and finally eventually got married to each other and had me. And so I, in some ways, owe my very existence to this great migration. I obviously, as you know, was a journalist for the New York Times for years, and that meant I traveled all over the country, and wherever I went, if I happened to be interviewing African Americans in Los Angeles or in Chicago or in Detroit or in New York, invariably the conversation would turn to a particular part of the South. Someone might say, I can't talk with you for much longer because I have to I'm heading back home for a family reunion in Louisiana. And they might be in Los Angeles at the time. Or if I'm in Chicago, someone would say, I've got to return home to Mississippi. If I were in Washington, there'd be constant references. Growing up, constant references.
Always going
to
back
North
home.
Carolina,
going back
always
home.
Going back home. I grew up around people, surrounded by people who, the parents of everyone I knew were from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia. That's just the way life was.
Well, I mean, that rings true for us here in Chapel Hill, because we've got friends, both white and black, whose families have moved north. And as you say, from here, there are a lot going to Washington, Baltimore, up the East Coast. Yeah. Well, I want you to give us a little bit of basic history before we talk about the three extraordinary characters who are the heart and soul of your book. What, you know, we talk about that great migration, but did it have a beginning and an ending? When did it begin, and what did it have an ebb and flow?
Well, first of all, I view it as the greatest underreported story of the 20th century, and that's because this great migration involved 6 million people, 6 million African Americans, who in some ways defected from a caste system known as Jim Crow. They began this departure from the South during World War I, and the reason...
World War I was the beginning of it,
and the precipitating event was the fact that the North had a labor need, a huge labor shortage, because it was World War I, and that was the European War, it was called the European War at the time, and that meant that immigration from Europe had essentially come to a halt. And these were the people, these European immigrants, were the ones who were working the foundries and the factories and the steel mills and the railroads of the North. When immigration was cut off during World War I, the North began to look around for the cheapest labor it could find, and it came to the South, to African Americans, who were the cheapest labor in the land, essentially. Many of them were being underpaid, woefully underpaid for their work, and others were not being paid at all because they were essentially working for the right to live on the land that they were farming, in other words, sharecroppers. And so the South, the North began to recruit people to work in these foundries.
Let me just, I want to come back to that,
yeah.
Right? But when did it end? When did the Great Migration end?
It ended in the 1970s. It did not end until the overarching common issue that they were all dealing with was finally resolved after the Civil Rights era. meaning the Jim Crow caste system came to an end during that time.
Now I want to get back to what you're talking about, and that's the migration out. And this is one of the most startling things that popped out at me, and I almost still don't believe it because I'm a, you know, a loyal white Southerner. And my view would have been, all right, if all these blacks want to leave, let them go. Let them go. That'd be good. You know, it'll make us all whiter, and send those blacks up there until the Northerners can know how much trouble we've been through. But
a New Orleans paper said that, actually.
Right, you report that, but that wasn't the way it was it?
The majority view was that this was not a good thing for the economy of the South because the economy of the South had depended on an oversupply of cheap labor in order to plant, to chop and harvest the cotton, the tobacco, the rice, the sugar cane that was in some ways the heart and soul of what made the Southern economy work. And without having that ready supply of cheap labor, that meant that the South's economy could not be dependent upon to be fueling itself under the circumstances.
Well, I would have always thought that if somebody wanted to leave, they could just leave. But the Southerners, you tell us some dirty stories about what Southerners did to keep black people there. It was almost like the Bible story of the children of Israel in Egypt. They had to break away.
Well, they had to break away. You know, before this migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South, 90%. And this great migration, at the end of this great migration, nearly half were living outside of the South, you know, for the entire arc from Washington, D.C. to Chicago and then over to the West Coast. It was extremely difficult for people to leave because there were tremendous efforts put upon the people in order to keep them from leaving. There were people who were actually arrested from their train seats once they were on the train heading north.
What was the violation of law? Well, I mean, why? How could you arrest somebody just for getting on a train?
Well, they weren't working. I mean, they had vagrancy laws.
So there were vagrancy laws. Wow.
Vagrancy. And by definition, they weren't working because they were in a train seat.
And so they arrested him for vagrancy. The other thing you talked about, laws that were passed to keep people from recruiting blacks.
That was astounding to me. The fact is that they worked on the supply side by keeping the people from leaving. They would arrest them on the railroad platforms, and when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the train on through, as they did in Summit, Mississippi. They were doing all kinds of things to keep them from leaving, but on the demand side, they also were doing things, and that was that they, Macon, Georgia, for example, set out a requirement that anyone who wanted to recruit an African-American worker had to first pay a $25,000 licensing fee.
$25,000, not $25.
$25,000 for World War I. That would be the equivalent of $500,000 now to recruit a single black person. So they were putting out tremendous barriers and walls to protect their labor.
So if you wanted to arrest the agent, you would arrest him not for doing it, but for not getting the license.
But for not for being caught doing this recruiting without a license.
Wow. Well, you want to talk a little bit about, I tell you what, let's take a quick break. And then we'll come back. I'm visiting with Isabel Wilkerson, who is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns. This is the story of the great migration of Southern blacks into the North. And she and I will continue our discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is Isabel Wilkerson. She is a Pulitzer Prize winning former journalist and now teacher at Boston College.
Boston University.
At BU. Mm-hmm. And you're teaching kids how to write nonfiction.
Journalism. And narrative nonfiction, which is what the book is.
Yeah, it sure is. It's better than fiction. It's almost as unbelievable. And one of the reasons that it's so powerful is that it takes the stories of three people who participated in this migration from all the way through their lives. And I mean, who's your favorite? Who should we talk about?
I do not have a favorite. People are insisting that I have a favorite, and I love them all.
Well, let me maybe a little bit more history, because our idea of this migration is that a bunch of sharecroppers and working blacks, uneducated, poor, unschooled, kind of made their way out of the South and went up north and populated the cities in the North. And it's not totally untrue. But it's mostly untrue.
There were sharecroppers, and a good number, obviously, of them were sharecroppers. But a great bulk of the people were actually from small towns throughout the South. It was not a haphazard unfurling of lost souls. In fact, it was three distinct migration streams out of the South, which is the kind of thing that people.
Now, will
don't
you describe
think
those? Will you describe those?
So there was one migration stream which involves where we happen to be right now, and that was up the East Coast. It carried people from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, Virginia, to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and even Boston.
That's your stream.
That's my stream, There's the middle stream, which was what carried people from Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, and Arkansas up the midsection of the United States, up to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland.
Sort of up the river.
Up the river.
Yeah.
It was actually the Illinois Central which carried them out.
Up the railroad line.
Yes.
Just north.
North. And then there was the newest stream, actually. It was the last stream of all, which is what carried people from Texas and Louisiana out to Los Angeles and just the entire West Coast. So there were three distinct streams. Each of those streams reflected essentially all classes of African Americans, from teachers and ministers to sharecroppers and business owners, all kinds of people, every possible combination, which is the reason why when I went out and did the research for this book, you know, I interviewed over 1,200 people. I went to senior centers, I went to AARP meetings, I went to Catholic churches in Los Angeles where everybody was from New Orleans, I went to Baptist churches in New York where everybody was from South Carolina. These things exist even to this day. There are all these colonies and clubs that exist in all of these places in the North where people are trying to replicate their experience.
Many of us who be comfortable, familiar, that visiting a black church in Chapel Hill might not be, or in the country, in Orange County, might not be that much different than visiting in a city like Los Angeles. And you did, I mean, was it in Los Angeles what did the preacher say to you? He said, be nice to this young lady.
Oh yes, that was in Los Angeles. We're praying for the lady and the book she's trying to write.
But I mean, that would just be typical of. Now, I would be very comfortable with that and expecting. Did that catch you off guard a little bit?
Oh no, I think it's beautiful because you know this is the thing that is so heartening and inspiring to me about both the Great Migration and my experiences working with this book. The people who left were Southerners, and they may have left the South, but the South never left them. And they passed on a lot of the values and the traditions and the culture to their children and their grandchildren, who then went on to, in some ways, be Southerners in themselves. In fact, I've been described as a Southerner once removed, and I love that. I think that's just lovely.
Well, let's talk. All right, you won't pick one of your favorites. One of your favorites is the three. We're visiting with Isabel Wilkerson, talking about The Warmth of Other Suns, which is the story of this great migration of African Americans out of the South into the big cities of the North. And the character who rang the most with me was George Starling, who is a Florida African American, a little bit different from Florida, but working class, rising up. And these were the black guys that I knew who were just struggling to get a little bit of college under them, often succeeding in getting a little bit of college, but not getting enough so that they could break out in the South.
Exactly.
And you get to be good enough friends so they would share with you the frustration about it. So tell us about George.
I'm
I mean,
so
George's
glad
story.
You asked about George, because the other two, Dr. Foster, who left Monroe, Louisiana for California, is quite flamboyant, and a lot
I
of
want
times
to talk about him
we
too.
Can talk about him. But George Starling he was from Florida. He's from Central Florida, where the essential work was picking citrus fruit. He had a little education, but the money had run out, and the father decided he didn't seem where it was worth it to keep sending him, having to save. He couldn't go to school in the county where he was because African Americans weren't permitted to go to the state.
This would
school.
Have been like 19.
This was in the 1930s, late 30s, early 40s. And so he ended up having to go back to picking citrus. But the working conditions were very difficult. It was dangerous, and they were being woefully underpaid. And
these
so
great oranges that we eat and we love and we romanticize from Florida, they don't come off the trees automatically.
No, someone has to climb up into those 40-foot trees and get all those oranges out of the tree at great peril to themselves. I mean, they could step onto a limb that was weak and fall and hurt themselves and essentially make themselves disabled for life, and there'd be nothing for them.
What made George leave?
So what made him leave was that he had been attempting to get a little bit more for the hard work that they were doing. He went and he would negotiate with the foreman to try to get maybe a nickel more a box for boxes that they were only getting maybe 12 cents a box. And those boxes were going to go out to the open market for $3 or $4. So it was very clear that there was a huge discrepancy between what they were making and what they were actually worth. But for having done that in the 1940s, this is World War II, that was really not acceptable for an African American to go in to negotiate with an employer in such a way. And so there was actually he got word that there had been a plot against him mm-hmm. for having done this.
I love this Bull Connor character. Like, I think his name was Willis McCall.
Willis McCall, the sheriff.
Who was the high sheriff.
The
and this
high
is
sheriff.
Lake a county, County down near... What, Disney World now, you know.
Yeah,
down,
just north of Disney World.
But in Orange
Disney World wasn't there then.
Yeah, I mean, this
long
is,
time.
This is just hard to believe that Florida was even, we think of Florida not as a southern state anymore, but it was really southern back when George was coming along. Now, so why didn't George just, George had to sneak out. Why couldn't he just leave?
Well, because there was a plot against him and the two friends of his that were working together out in the fields and had been actually having some success in negotiating higher wages. They'd wait till they got out to the groves, and then they would say, well, we're not going to pick unless you can pay us a nickel more a box. And the grove owners didn't take to that kindly at all. There had been some standoffs in the groves, and it was very perilous at that time. That was an era where people were being arrested on the streets for vagrancy, even on a Saturday, or from their homes for not working, because there's this great demand for the north in the north for oranges and orange juice to have with their ham.
Let's
and
just
eggs.
Back up, because this is hard for me to deal with, and that is that these black workers, if they decided to take a Saturday off, then not only would they risk losing their jobs or having a problem, but the law was going to come arrest them for not working.
There's a tremendous amount of documentation. This is not even from the oral histories that I got. When I interviewed all these people, I actually believe a lot of the people that I interviewed actually were holding back a great deal from what they were experiencing. The documents and the written records in the newspapers and in other histories actually were more extreme than what the people even told me. There were examples of Willis McCall, and he proudly would say that he would go out and arrest the people. He would arrest the people from their homes for not working on a Saturday, and that was the charge.
That was his part of his job.
That was his job.
What he needed to get reelected by the white people
exactly.
of that county, was to help the economy by keeping the workers, mostly black, in line and at work.
They needed to get that harvest out.
It was like,
their economy
depended not much
it.
Different from... the times of slavery, when you'd have a master who would round you up and make you go to work even when you didn't want, on Saturdays, even when you didn't want
to. That was
to.
More perilous than we can even imagine now. It doesn't even sound like the United States
it
of
really
America.
Doesn't. Well, George also is, anyway, this is a guy who has equivalent of a junior college education
yes.
and ambition to be
more than
something
that.
More. And also, this rang true with me, because this is a guy who's I'm a white person, I call him a troublemaker. And he would say, I'm just not going to be pushed around. I mean, and there would be times when he bit his lip, he tried not to do it, but he just couldn't help it. He wasn't going to be pushed around by white people, and it got him in trouble.
It got him in trouble, so that he and his two friends who had been working out there, they were the young people out there in the groves trying to get these get better conditions for the people that out in the groves when they were working. He ended up having to, all three of them ended up having to flee for their lives, essentially, and they all fled north, one to Washington, D.C., one to Rochester, New York, and George himself to New York City, to Harlem.
Well, there's so much more to this story, we can't talk about it, but one of the things that interested me was what he found in New York City and how he adapted to it and what were his problems. And what were the good things about being in New York?
Well, the good thing was that they recreated their experience in the South in the North. I mean, he was surrounded by people who were from the same Florida towns as he was, which is what most of them did, believe it or not. They actually, one of his friends would go out and hunt possum. That would be a very big deal. They'd go up to Connecticut and hunt possum
right.
just as they'd done back here. So there was this desire to recreate their own world up there. The problem was that it was much more expensive expensive to live there than it had been here. It was a forbidding, hostile, and alien world where the people often had to work, very long hours or 2 and 3 jobs just to be able to survive there. There was a tremendous amount of pressure on them to do that. And for them to be able to survive meant that they would often have to leave their children unattended. They didn't have the same community and extended family to be able to watch out for the kids. And so one of the things that happened to him and to many, many other families is that they had no idea what they were stepping into when they went into these big forbidding cities of the North. And they had no idea what their children were being exposed to in these big crowded cities where people were living one on top of the other. There were numbers runners and policy kings, and there were gang members, and there were hustlers and all kinds of people who could easily pick off the children of these people who were working, long hours in order to make it in the big North. And so that's one of the things that happened to him.
How
as
did
well.
George make a living up there?
He made a living. He got a job. And he got a job as a railroad porter, which meant that he ended up having to go right back north and south. The very place that he had left, he kept coming back and forth. He actually was very careful, though, because he did not take a route that would take him back to Eustis, Florida. As long as the sheriff was there and as long as all the people who were there who had been threatened by his activities of trying to round up the workers in search of better pay, better work conditions. As long as they were still there, he took a route that took him to Birmingham.
Well, I don't want to challenge you about your own book, but one of my favorite passages of the book was when he did pass by his hometown and he saw the sheriff, just for a brief encounter. And he was able to. Will you tell that story?
Well, the thing is, in those small towns, everybody knew one another. And Sheriff Willis McCall was someone who would come into George's father happened to have a convenience store, mm-hmm. and the sheriff would come in and he'd just help himself to whatever he wanted because he could do it. I mean, what was his,
who's going to stop
what
him?
Who was going to stop him? And so when on one of the routes when that George was on that happened to come through Wildwood, it turned out the sheriff was actually escorting one of his prisoners off the train. And he saw George, and he said, "Aren't you George Starling's boy?" And, George Starling had been in the North for a while and didn't really take well to that kind of reference to him. So he said, "Well, I'm George Starling's son," and he kind of stood up for himself. He would not have said that if he wasn't on a train that was in the North. He was getting ready to go.
Well, and this sheriff, I mean, gosh, the book is full of these stories, but this sheriff was the one really that he was afraid of when he left, who was going to track him down and probably, well, we don't know, but maybe even take so far as to kill him, to lynch him.
They could have done whatever they wanted.
They were really after him. Well, I want to talk some more about George, but there are several other people who are key to your story. So let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about them. I'm visiting with Isabel Wilkerson. She's the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about this wonderful part of American history that we know a lot about because we know people and families that are part of it, but it hadn't made it to the history books maybe the way it should. Isabel Wilkerson, you're the author of this great book about it. When you're trying to get somebody's attention about how important this migration is in American life, what are some of the gems that you pull? What's your elevator speech about? You want to know about this migration.
Well, I say that this was the one of the greatest transfers of Southern culture that has really occurred within the country in the course of our history. We had 6 million people who were Southerners who transported the South, both in their luggage with the King James Bibles, with their 12-string guitars, and in their hearts. Many of the people brought all the Southern traditions with them. And what they ultimately did was it became a marriage of the North and the South as their children went on to, in some ways, become some of the most prominent people of the 20th century. That's one of the things I like to be able to remind people of.
Yeah,
and I
think you give a lot of illustrations.
Southerners should all, I believe we should all take pride in the fact that this was a triumph in some ways of
Southern
culture.
So this is the way, and if you want to really counter, you can say, we couldn't conquer the North in the Civil War, but the Great Migration the South was able to impose its culture on the rest of the country.
Well, through these people, unwittingly. Yeah. These became unwitting ambassadors of Southern culture. Much of what we view as American culture is culture that grew out of this great migration of people from the South to the North. What these people did was they created whole new art forms. Jazz would never have existed had there been no great migration. And some of the greatest contributors to this whole new art form were from North Carolina. When you think about Thelonious Monk, his parents had migrated from here to Harlem when he was 5 years old, where he got the opportunity really to be able to, he was this genius. They carried the spirituals and the gospel music of the South with them, and it had an opportunity to flourish there in this new world, and he became one of the best known people in jazz. John Coltrane, he left when he was 17 years old, carried the jazz, carried the gospel and the blues and the spirituals inside of him, and then went to Philadelphia where he got his first alto sax. He got his first alto sax in Philadelphia, which was in some ways a capital of it was like North Carolina,
the
North.
The capital of the Northern South.
Exactly, capital of the Northern South. How about that? So he had the chance to do that. Where would jazz be? Where would music be?
Oh, it's a great story. Well, I love that story, and I love all the history in your book that set some of the records straight that I've been confused about. But what I love more than anything are these stories of these people. And one of the people that I really loved, that I identified with, was Ida May. And, she's just a cotton picker. she's just straight off the sharecropping farms of the South, a typical,
because she was terrible at picking cotton.
Yeah, she was a bad cotton.
I love that. I never thought about being good or bad at it, but she actually was bad at it.
Well, she was said to be really bad about it, but she did it, and she would go out on that, even on the last day that she was there. But this is terrible, because this is just at the end of the story. But she hated this. She didn't like, she knew she was bad.
I know where you're going.
But when she was an older woman and got to go home, what did she want to do?
Well, I went back with her.
I took
her back, and her family let me take her back with me. And we were driving.
So where were you?
We were in Chickasaw County, Mississippi, and it was at the harvest time. It was around October of the year that we went, which is about the time of year that she left originally. We're driving down a 2-lane road heading into the county, and we pass all this cotton that's ready to be picked, hadn't been picked yet, empty, no one else on the road. And as we're driving, she just said, "Well, let's stop the car." And I said, "Well, what are we going to do?" She said, "Well, let's go pick some." And I said, "This cotton belongs to somebody, or is that okay? And, we're in Mississippi beyond all of that." And she said, "Oh, they won't care what little bit we pick." And so she got out there. She couldn't wait to get out there and start picking. It was almost as if it was reactivating some ancient memory within her.
So this is like 60 years.
Oh, she hadn't been in Mississippi for 60 years. I mean, she had not picked cotton for 60 years.
I mean, this is, for me, the lesson of memory, that sometimes we want to recreate our worst memory. The other thing that you told about in this story that she told about having not been a good cotton picker, and and it's hard, awfully back-breaking work, that she gets up to the North and she starts missing the fellowship that was a part of that hard work, that memory comes back more than the backbreaking part of it.
Yes, because what they had done is that they had found a way to make a life for themselves and to make peace with the situation that they were in. She, in particular, is a great lesson in that. The book is about the Great Migration. It's called The Warmth of Other Suns, and it's about the Great Migration. But ultimately, it's a story about survival. It's a story about courage. It's a story about dignity and what it takes to maintain that. So she found a way. One reason why she was actually, I consider her, a very successful person in a way that we don't often think of success, is because she happened to have one of the hardest lives a person could have had in the 20th century. Just all kinds of deprivation.
On both sides, both before she
both
left.
Before
and
she left, and even when she got to Chicago, they ended up buying a 3-flat in a neighborhood that ended up being overrun in some ways by gang activity. Not the majority of the people there, but all it takes is just a few, and it makes life difficult for everyone there. She moved into a neighborhood neighborhood that emptied of its white people within months of her arrival. So she experienced a lot of the things that we consider the hardship of life in the North and in the South. And yet she found a way of maintaining the best of both places. She never changed her Mississippi accent for the entire time that she was living in the North. She lived in the North actually longer than she did in the South. And yet she retained all of the things. She could make sweet potato pie like anybody in the Delta, but she kept track of what was going on with the mayor's races and with the Chicago Bulls. She was following the defensive line.
All right, well,
of
this
that.
Leads me to one of my favorite stories in your book. And, you know, the encounters with celebrities are always fun. Oh. And Ida Mae got interested in politics early on, and she, of course, couldn't vote in Mississippi, and she didn't know what voting was about.
No.
But once she got into it, she was. And so there was this minor political figure that she happened to run into that struck me as interesting, that she tipped her hat to him. Well, who? Tell us this story and tell us who.
Well, she happened to live in a district called South Shore in Chicago, and that happened to be a district that was predominantly black. It had emptied of its white people, which was one of the things that happened in the North. People talk about what's happened in the South, but this is what happened in the North. And it was a neighborhood that had a lot of challenges as a result of this emptying out of people. And so there was a person who became the new state senator of her district. He was someone that a lot of people hadn't heard of before because he wasn't originally from Chicago. He had a wife who actually was from that part of Chicago. And what she used to do is in order to try to keep the community in better shape, she and other homeowners would go to community meetings every month, once a month, at the Presbyterian church. You go to the basement of the church, and there would be all kinds of politicians who would come in and make their
pitches.
Chicago politics. They'd come in.
I want to get my road fixed.
The aldermen and all that would come in. But one particular day, and usually they come in with a big entourage and lights and cameras, but one day a very quiet man came in, very slender, tall, boyish looking, and he came in and it was announced that he was the new state senator for their district. Now, that was not a very popular title to have. No one really paid much attention to what the state senators did because they were kind of invisible. They'd be in Springfield and they could never connect exactly what they were doing. They weren't the ones that fixed the potholes or got the gangbangers off the street. They did things like health care and that sort of thing. And so he came in and he made his announcement, and people listened very graciously. And then they went back to wanting to talk to the police about what was going on in the community when it came to crime. The man walked up the steps after he'd made his announcement, and very few people would have realized that they had just seen the man who would become the first African American president of the United States. Her state senator was Barack Obama.
Well.
And she was one of the first people to ever have voted for him because that was the first position he'd ever run for office for.
Well, what a great story. This sharecropper, uneducated woman, makes it to Chicago and helps get Barack Obama's political career going.
Exactly.
We're visiting with Isabel Wilkerson, talking about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. She and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, talking about one of the great stories of American history, and many of us know people who participated in it. The book is The Warmth of Other Suns. It's the story of the black migration out of the South into the cities of the North, and it's written by Isabel Wilkerson, who's been in Chapel Inn as our guest today. Isabel, thank you again for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
Well, your book is a wonderful history book, and it sets straight a lot of misunderstanding about this. But the power of the book is really in the people, and we've talked about two of them. Another person who's a part of this migration, I would have judged this is not typical. This is a professional person migrating. Will you tell us his story?
Yes, this is Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, Dr. Foster. He had been a surgeon in the Army, and he'd been a surgeon during the Korean conflict. Based actually in Europe. When he got out of the Army, it turned out he couldn't practice surgery in his own hometown, which was Monroe, Louisiana. And so he set out on a course to go to California, which he thought would offer him better prospects for being able to practice as a surgeon.
Why did he want to leave?
He wanted to leave for multiple reasons. One is he couldn't practice in his own hometown. They would not permit African-American black doctors to work in the hospital. It's called St. Francis Hospital in Monroe. And as a surgeon, he needed to be able to have a hospital to work in because he was not a family practitioner. And so it wasn't possible for him at all. He also had a young family that he wanted to be able to have his daughters grow up in a place where they would be safe and have opportunities for education. So he set out on this course, and he was going to be driving the way by himself, and he was going to send for his family after he got situated, which is kind of the thing that immigrants mm-hmm. do when you think about mm-hmm. it. He was going to be driving ultimately nearly 2,000 miles by himself, and he had set out this journey thinking that he'd be able to, once he got past a certain point, he'd be able to stop and he'd be out of the Jim Crow caste system, which had limited him otherwise.
It's even hard these days for us to remember that in North Carolina and in every part of the rest of the South, black person had to be very creative to find a place to stay.
Very
couldn't
creative.
Stay in a regular hotel or motel.
And couldn't be assured of being able to get food on the road, go into a restaurant. There were many limits on them. Even gas could be difficult to
obtain.
But he
thought once he got out of Texas into New Mexico and Arizona, he could do it. And it didn't work out that way. And it's a memory that was seared in his brain for the rest of his
life. He never got
over it. He told me that story over and over and over again.
He said, this thing I've gone over 3,000 times. And he was driving through the desert at night, and he thought that he'd be able to find a place because night had fallen. And it turned out that over and over and over again, he was turned away from people who clearly had a vacancy sign out there, but would not rent him a room.
Sorry, Doc, I just rented my last room.
Just rented our last room. And even as he was driving away from that place, there was a vacancy sign still blinking. So he knew that this meant that Jim Crow, as he understood it, had actually extended far beyond the boundaries that we typically think of.
When he got to Los Angeles, he found that Jim Crow had visited Los Angeles.
Well, it
as
turns
well.
Out that they called it James Crow in California. Yeah, so it was he found that there were also many limits and restrictions on him. He had to work really hard in order to create a practice for himself. There were a lot of restrictions and challenges because it turned out that many of the African Americans who were already there were not all that excited about these new arrivals coming in. They faced incredible challenges going into these big cities, and learning about that helped me to have a great deal of empathy in some ways for what they had gone through. About it afterward, and they didn't tell their children and grandchildren because it was too painful to talk about.
One of the stories that I'm surprised he was willing to tell you was that there was a prejudice against black doctors in the what in that time we call colored, and you use that term to refer in the colored community. He went out and in a job doing medical, calling on houses to do medical exams. He examined the husband. And then when he came to the wife, she said, uh-uh. She said, I can't use the word, but she said, I'm not going to let any black doctor examine me. She's a black person. You'd think, oh, gosh, she'd love it that there's a black professional, but it didn't work that way.
She had internalized the very caste system and all of the assumptions that were already in place in the larger society. She'd internalized that and would not let this doctor, who was a surgeon, and actually was in some ways beneath him to even do such a simple, to take her blood pressure was well beneath his capabilities, and yet she wouldn't let him even do that. So he ran into a lot of roadblocks, and all of them ran into roadblocks from places that you wouldn't expect. From recent immigrants from other countries, other parts of the world who had arrived in this country and wanting the same thing as them, but they also were resisting and feeling threatened by their arrival. African Americans who were there already in the North were resenting and resisting their arrival. Yeah. There were assumptions made about them merely because they were Southern. They had they had accents that were considered different from others. There were assumptions made about them on the basis of that. They had a really hard and difficult time, and yet they didn't give up because they couldn't give up. In other words, for people like that, people who make this great leap of faith and jumping into the unknown, they couldn't, failure is not an option. Failure is not an option because they couldn't have the people back home say, see, I knew you weren't going to make it.
You had to come back. Well,
so
there are two
great
story about this doctor. There are two things. I'm celebrity conscious, of course, and one of the things, I want you to tell the story if you can quickly, but Robert had a song written about him.
Had a song written about him.
By a pretty famous guy.
By a pretty famous guy who also was a part of the Great Migration, Ray Charles, who'd come from Florida and went to Seattle and ended up in Los Angeles, became one of his patients. His most famous patient was Ray Charles. And Ray Charles had such great gratitude for him because Ray Charles actually cut himself and damaged his hand to such a degree that he actually might not have been able to continue to play, which would have been devastating for him. And this would have been in the early 1960s. Yeah. And so Dr. Foster, Robert Foster, sewed him up and actually saved his hand. And as a result of that, Ray Charles had a song written about his
doctor. That made the charts.
That made the charts.
Well, this is
Hide
just
Nor
great,
Hair.
Great. And a great story about Ray Charles and to prove it. Ray Charles is named a son.
Named after, a son. He has a son named Robert after him, who Dr. Foster delivered.
The other thing, real quickly, that is a connection with this academic community in Chapel Hill is that Dr. Foster married the daughter of the president of the Atlanta University, Dr. Clement, Rufus Clement, who
yes.
is a force in himself, and we don't have time to talk to him, but that's another book, I think.
And then there's a reference to W.B. Du Bois as a whole
yeah,
thing
he's the guy
him.
who ousted him. Yeah, that's another story. We're out of time. And it's not the only story that we've missed talking about, the important thing is that which you cover through these stories is this tremendous reorganization of our country and, as you point out, recreating or re-energizing American culture through the great migration that you describe in your book, The Warmth of Other Suns. Thank you, Isabel Wilkerson, for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking, D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here soon.